Why?
Art of self-defense. I'm not interested in killing. I just want to prove how bad your kicks are. That's what we call control. Something you may never understand.
This is Ink Studs on CITR 101.9 FM. My guest today is Nathan Fox. And you don't have a lot of comic work, I guess, but great stuff nonetheless. Pigeons from Hell, which just came out in the old trade paperback format last month, not too long ago.
Yeah, not too long ago.
And the other being your Fluorescent Black series, which is occasionally running in heavy metal. Which is
fantastic. It looks like the second part's going to hit at San Diego Comic-Con this year and also next year, and then be collected next year, I believe, as well. And then before all that was the DMZ stuff that kind of got me where I am right now, and some fill-in stuff before then when I was busting my chops at DC.
What did you do at DC before?
The first gig I got was Batman Black and White. I'm not too sure I'll ever be allowed to do Batman again after that, but he was normal and had a pooch and saved a kid. A little baby, so it didn't go over too well with the editors, but I got some cool responses, and it was awesome work with Chemo Temperance, a fellow Canadian, I believe, and so that was really awesome, and learned a lot from that, and then that led to a Harley Quinn fill-in, and some other small Detective Comics kind of eight-page thingers here, and then it pretty much dropped off until the cold call from Brian about the DMZ.
So did Brian know your work from your illustration work or from those couple of
comics? I'm not totally sure on the story of that one, but if I remember right, the first time we ever formally really met or work-wise was the Fight for Tomorrow cover that I did for his series. And I guess he really liked it and held on to it. And then after those other fill-ins and the Batman thing came out, I think he and I talked to Will a couple of times too about future work and kind of sent all my illustration stuff. So I'm sure he probably got a hold of all that stuff through Will at Vertigo, and that kind of led to that. And So it was awesome. I was a fan of the series, and I talked to Brian a couple times actually before then, after the cover I was on the pitch for local and some other stuff. But it went to other people who did a much better job than I probably ever would have. So that was cool. But just to be considered for all that stuff starting in comics was great. I definitely came into all this stuff late and just kind of after grad school, just started getting into it. So it was pretty awesome to have Brian call out of the clear blue at the beginning of everything.
What? Because you've been doing illustration work for quite a while before comics, right?
Yeah, I'm now a full-time freelance illustrator. And I went to the Art Institute for animation and illustration and lean more towards illustration, and then got out of there in 97, and then went to grad school and got out of there in 2002.
What did you do your grad work in?
In illustration at the SVA MFAI program that Marshall Larisman leads. It's a majorly a narrative program, so you could be a gallery artist, a kid's book illustrator, a sculptor, a random painter who chews their toenails on the weekends. It doesn't really matter. It's more of like a storytelling program and you know, kind of problem solving through images. So that kind of gave me the confidence to give comics a try. I never really thought I could do it.
So what made you want to jump into comics if you're doing illustration work? Because usually it's the other way around. People are more fundamental about going into comics and realizing it's not paying, so they go and do some illustration work.
Yeah, the whole pay scale is totally screwed up for some reason. But I don't know, I never really read comics as a kid aside from Calvin and Hobbes and Garfield when I refused to read my school books. But I don't really know. I got into comics in college through friends' bookshelves. I pretty much was exposed to everything. I went to school for Disney and heard Tom Waits and saw Akira and started changing my mind really fast. It was eye-opening. I mean, I ended up kind of having a pretty sheltered child Disneyhood. So once I started seeing all that, I was already into gallery work and contemporary art and museums, and I spent most of my time in printmaking and photo video, and I mean, pretty much all of those. I mean, you're really just telling stories, and especially with photo video and painting, I always was drawn to sequential illustrative work, even though you wouldn't really call them illustrators, but definitely storytellers, and, you know, people who captured life and the figure. And so I kind of got an animator's figurative education and then started tweaking illustration through the printmaking and painting photo video electives, which I spent most of my time in anyway. And just tried to kind of figure all that stuff out. And at the same time, my roommates were Jim Mahfood and Mike Huddleston and Paul Chatham and some other people that are, you know, loosely connected to comic now. And Hector Casanova went there, and Harold Sipe, and the last couple of years, I think Matt Fraction was at the same school, but he was in the photo video department at the time. And, you know, it was just kind of this awesomely all-inclusive, saturated comic narrative situation, but I had no idea what I was really in at the time. It took years to realize that all I was doing or being influenced by was, you know, storytelling. So by the time I got to grad school, I started waking up and figuring all this stuff out and finally dropped the shyness of putting panels next to each other instead of just one single image and started giving it a try. The awesome thing about illustration is it's always new. So instead of, you know, page by page, panel by panel, you're focusing everything into one image.
Mm-hmm.
But you're solving somebody else's problem. You know, you're just doing it through your art or your eye or vision.
You're kind of given a concept and then you play with it and kind of
Yeah, and it's kind of safe in terms of comics because you're only dealing with one image. You're not responsible for continuity except on, like, larger packages that are connected or multiple images within an article or whatnot. But, you know, so after doing one image for so long, I really, really wanted to give it a, you know, the old the old team heave-ho. And,
the old college try?
The old college try and see the old grad school try. And, you know, and see if it would work. And I, through Jim, I got Bob Schreck's contact and just started showing him stuff. And, you know, he liked it a lot, but said he had no friggin' idea what to do with me. So keep bringing it back because he's got nothing for me. And two or three years later is when I got the Batman Black and White thing. And mm-hmm. and a lot of my influences, I have to admit, are, you know, and thankfully, you know, comic artists and creators, and especially a lot of Japanese and now manga creators that I've kind of discovered. So I'm doing a lot of European Asian art history as much as I'm doing early American comic book art history, so kind of discovering I have a lot of interests that aren't really connected to the 80s or 90s, but more overseas and early on. So it's been pretty cool.
So you're talking like for European, like guys like Mobius?
Kind of. Like Benet and Jordi Bernet and mm-hmm. Otomo and especially currently like Samora and a lot of other guys whose names I'm totally blanking on right now. Jeff Darrow was always a really big influence because I've always had a penchant for detail for some reason, and he didn't make me feel so bad about filling every millimeter of the page with detail. Which has been a really nice challenge and is extremely hard. So you know, all of that kind of started to come together, and Kniff in the U.S. Was a big one for me. Mm-hmm. And once I started collecting all this stuff after grad school, I started realizing that I'd kind of grown up with all these images, and I had really hadn't paid attention to them when I was a kid. So especially the Jordi Bernet and the Kniff stuff, I'd always seen it around. I just never knew what it was, or even had the gumption to look into it. So now it's been pretty awesome, kind of going back through and continuing the comic book education.
I never even thought about the Kniff influence, but looking at the work, I can definitely see that as like kind of an afterthought. Like
yeah, and I'm a big fan of pinups and sex and violence and hot rods. And A lot of great kind of like lowbrow, mechanical, ergonomic, physics related stuff, and I've always been into science and kind of how things work from the inside out. So all everything's just kind of, or at least kind of feels like now like I'm really just now kind of getting started on something that might have some legs and some breadth to it.
Did you ever check out Hugo Pratt or Alex Toth?
Yeah, actually, Toth and I recently started looking at. Like I said before, I'm pretty slow. So as things go, and I kind of meet people and find out their influences, I'm starting to get a bit more of what's going on. And then Kubert or however you say that. His Sergeant Rock stuff really kind of blew me away, and I think it's Williamson and Alex Raymond.
Mm-hmm.
The Flash Gordon stuff I always loved, although I'll never be able to draw that well. And you know, so I'm kind of steeped in history right now, and trying to find my way out of it through pages and ink.
Do you find stylistically you're kind of changing as you take in more of these historical examples into your own kind of repertoire?
Yeah. I don't think anybody could really get away from that. Especially when you start out, it's very easy to absorb whoever you're looking at and kind of move forward with what you're given, as opposed to trying to push through it or kind of go beyond it. But now that I kind of went through that early on in undergrad. It's been pretty awesome to see things structurally and how they're created and take that as knowledge as opposed to a cookie cutter or stylistic way of working.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been pretty cool to read all these comics and kind of break it down and see the wireframe of how it's put together and where the blacks were used and how, you know, the weight distribution and the characters and the shadows were dropped and lighting and composition, panel structure, and just kind of getting that education now as I'm just now getting some work, which actually makes it kind of harder and a bit more frustrating because I never really had any formal training in any of this. I'm a big fan of movies, and I've always kind of paused the movies, especially for the illustration stuff, to see how the image was composed and the lighting and cinematography, and David Mamet fan, and, you know, just kind of watched too many movies and read a few film books and got really interested in the construction of imagery and the communication of characters. And so I've just kind of gotten into all of that at one huge time. And it's been pretty...
A sensory awesome. Overload.
A little bit, actually. And trying to juggle both, I would not recommend to anybody. Editorial and comics don't really mix unless you can turn anything down you want, and that's certainly not the position I'm in.
One thing is listening to you talk about these influences and stuff, and one thing that strikes me about them all, which is complete opposite of you, is they're, I'd say, 95% black and white, but your stuff I find very kind of hyper-colored.
Yeah.
So I'm interested to see how that works. Because, I mean, it's very different kind of way.
Yeah, very, very much so. Well, I think the illustration stuff is kind of where I got all the color experience in. I mean, you got to kind of do everything. And, I mean, to be honest, in the comics, I'm having more fun with black and white and finding it more challenging than just the color work. There's a lot of different ways to look at it. I've always been a fan of color theory, and now that I'm a father, watching all these awesome cartoons that I grew up with that thankfully my daughter likes, you know, like Popeyes and the Flintstones, and what was that Barbarians one? I can't. There's all these old Hanna-Barbera's, and
yeah.
Actually, that was an Alex Toth one. He designed all the characters.
He did a lot of Hanna-Barbera stuff.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm like, obviously, I'm slow. I'm like figuring all this shit.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
Summer wind.
those days and nights went flying by. The world was new beneath the blue umbrella sky. Then softer than a hyperman, one day it called to you. And I lost you to the summer.
Music Waste 2009 is now accepting submissions. This year's festival runs June 10th to 13th.
This summer, Music Waste will be celebrating 15 years of independence.
As the other local independent music festivals, large and small, have come and gone, Music Waste will once again highlight Vancouver's most interesting and innovative music. A testament to the strength of this musical community and the wealth of talent, Music Waste is Vancouver's independent music festival.
Submission deadline, April 15th.
Please email your submissions to submissions@musicwaste.ca. And, or for more information, contact Cameron Reed by email at cameron@musicwaste.ca or visit the website at www.musicwaste.ca.
Right now. Jeff Darrow was always a really big influence because I've always had a penchant for detail for some reason, and he didn't make me feel so bad about filling every millimeter of the page.
About the story.
Well, I just
I do it, I scream for the nation. Sucking on the Benson, trying to
There's a certain, and this kind of goes through all your work, hyper-violence I find in it.
What are you talking about? I make kids' books.
For very violent kids. Was that a lot of your own kind of vision, or did Joe really have a kind of a bloody vision for it? And I love blood, you know, I'm fine with that.
No, I mean, it was definitely a messy story. I mean, a lot of it was in the script, but I think I probably took liberties with the gore at certain points, and I wanted it to be creepy. I mean, it is, the original story is a really, really creepy story, and it turned out that from where we were from, Joe and I were both from Texas, and I traveled to, you know, East Texas and Louisiana, and even as a Boy Scout, like camping in the Devil's Backbone and other like places throughout Texas, and traveling through Louisiana, that shit out there is really fucking creepy. And you know, drawing on all those memories and fears as a kid and a chubby little Boy Scout and like all this other shit, it to be honest, it really helped. And you know, I really got into the characters and the scene in the house just from those experiences, and you know, all the research I did on the slave plantations and Louisiana and the swamps and that era, and then kind of transferring that with, you know, being a college kid and having a car and getting a hold of the house and your friends and, you know, who the annoying little geek is and why he has to die before the first issue's over. And, you know, like, all these things, you know, it was great simplicity in the end. It all just kind of fell together. As soon as I started reading it, I knew exactly what they needed to look like. You know, a couple of the characters were really hard because I knew they had to be right. Because if I got them wrong, the story would just fall to pieces. Or at least for me, I think I did an okay job. Hopefully it reads as well. And, you know, I wanted to make it as creepy as possible, and that definitely meant not trying to hold back on what came out of what opening. So I definitely wanted to put that in there. And I'd always been attracted to car crashes and pulling things apart and I'd always like drawing anatomy because you could take the skin off, and But bodies are amazing. I mean, the human body is an amazing machine.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a biological machine, and in one way to look at it. So, you know, I'd always been fascinated with that. You know, so I kind of wanted to explore ripping it apart as much as I could.
That's nice and bloody.
I have great dreams, but I'm really a happy guy. I think that's probably all I could say to salvage my reputation right now.
Now, your other big comic project you have going on is the Fluorescent Black, which is...
Another kid's book.
Another kid's book for only the most imaginative of children. From that timeless children's anthology, Heavy Metal.
Yeah, the Under the Mattress in the Shoebox.
Tell, who is the guy you're collaborating with on that?
It's Matt Wilson, M.F. Wilson, and he's a screenwriter in California, and he was working for Imagi at the time, and had optioned the screenplay, but wanted to get the comic done first. So another cold call out of nowhere. I mean, he literally. I think the story goes, as he tells it, is he was looking for comic book illustrators, and I guess he typed it in, and my name popped up with a phone number, and he liked what he saw, so he called the phone number. And so that kind of got us talking, and I was flattered by the call, and you know, but kind of suspicious of a random call of, hey, I got this script, it's really cool. I want to run it in Heavy Metal, which immediately stopped me because I stopped reading Heavy Metal for quite a while. and I was like, okay, well, I always love reading stuff, you know. Send it over. I'll be happy to check it out, you know. But I can't promise anything. And so he flattered me enough to send it over after my little push away with caution. And after about 30 pages, I called him back and asked him if, you know, I said, blah, 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 is this how it ends, and is this really who this person is? And he said, yeah, and I said, well, I haven't even read all the way through it, but I'm in. So we started talking some more and you know, just figuring out the characters and everything else, and met him a few times got to develop some stuff in person, which was really beneficial. I really enjoy collaboration, and was lucky enough to talk Jeremy Cox into jumping on board, the DMZ colors guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I got together on the color, and then he just went nuts and developed it further, and it'll hopefully end up being some. A very nice and insane 3 48-page part epic.
To eventually be collected.
Yeah, to be collected in 2010, I believe.
It's interesting that you work closely with the colorist, because it does have, I guess the coloring does really go with the title, that really like sharp, vibrant colors in this kind of dirty, gringy world. Is that kind of your vision, or was that something that the writer wanted, or?
I think we'd all kind of wanted it, but I don't know, through all the illustration stuff, the color became really important, because it was one of the only tools aside from a single image that you could use to construct the mood, arrange the lighting, you know, give location, and I mean Singapore is very specific.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we wanted it to have that feel. Matt did a ton of research on the language, and you know, did according to the response he's gotten from people that live there and have come from there, is you know, it's very, very true to the location and all the languages and cultures that exist there. And you know, he had his idea of what it was, and I always tend to go overboard with almost everything, and you know, so color was definitely something that after talking, we wanted to get in there, and the only colorist I really knew was Jeremy, and he and I had had so much fun on the DMZ stuff that it was kind of a no-brainer to talk to the only colorist I knew who I ended up, you know, really liking, and he turned out to be an awesome Viking, and in real life, and we kind of hit it off, and he was really looking forward to kind of going crazy and doing some wacky color treatments, and it just kind of fit. So mm-hmm. we just tried to develop it. You know, the first few pages, you know, we kind of went back and forth on a few times trying to get it right, but in the end, it's definitely Jeremy's color.
Yeah.
And Jeremy's take on it, you know, we just kind of brainstormed on everything, and even same thing with the script, just kind of, which was really cool, because going back and forth with Matt was really great on ideas and polishing. It was his first comic, and I had always wanted to be a writer, but I should not be trusted to write anything. And but you know, like scenes and kind of storytelling, it was great. Outlining and kind of the beginning threads of how to put beginning, middle, and end together, and kind of dealing with characters and scenarios and giving them their voice. And he's a professional screenwriter, and you know, so just kind of, you know, definitely an education from start to finish, and mm-hmm. then we still have the last third to go. And originally it was just supposed to be 2 48-page sections, and you know, once everybody kind of bit the bullet and added on the rest, and we kept pushing for more pages, the story just got better.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Matt's voice really came through, hopefully by the end it'll end up being what it needs to be.
Well, I look forward to seeing where the story goes. I was quite sucked in and enthralled with it, so.
Oh, awesome. Thanks. Yeah, I'm finishing inking the second part right now, and there's more happy trees and flowers,
singing children, and
a lot of hand holding and skipping. It's good.
Now, in some illustration work recently, you had a piece in the Beast book 2.
Yeah,
and it's a lovely thing of this. Tell me about the piece. It's this kind of werewolf-type creature.
Oh, yeah, it's a chupacabra.
Ah.
Which is, if I'm probably going to get this totally wrong, since it's been a while since I did the research, but a Mexican goat-sucking eater mm-hmm. character. And it's had a lot of like fake photos and all this other stuff kind of created around like the urban myths of this animal that eats and sucks the blood out of goats and kind of what it looked like, and everybody kept, or at least all the images I saw were kind of these paparazzi kind of drive by quick snapshot of the carcass that's left kind of thing. And I thought it'd be pretty funny if, you know, you were driving by and you only got one little glimpse as the car lights went by, of seeing this creature turning around to look at you while it's sucking the blood out of this goat. So that's kind of where the image came from.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like a dog, but had like the head and structure of a goat as well. And I kept finding like conflicting information on exactly what it was, because nobody really knows what it is. So I just kind of started doodling and came up with the crazy thing that's on there right now. And since everything is a government conspiracy anyway, I put a barcode on one of its heels. so we can know it came out of some lab somewhere.
What attracted you to drawing that creature? Because as far as I know, people were kind of given a list and were able to choose.
Yeah. Well, I was kind of surprised that nobody had chosen it. It had always been like this mythological thing this urban myth thing that had always existed. And there were a bunch of others that I wanted to do. I'm a big fan of Japanese folklore, and the kappa was already taken. And There were some others in there that I could have chosen, but I was kind of surprised that nobody had done the Chupacabra. And I think to be from the Texas thing, you know, I'd always kind of heard about it, but never, you know, never really seen it or looked at it in any mm-hmm. of the pictures that were in the variety magazines and the tabloids and stuff. So I felt obligated to do a little piece of Scary Home, and we was working on Pigeons anyway, and was wrapping it up, and was kind of in the crouching, hunching monster mode. So it definitely seemed to fit at the time.
What are some of the tools you like to use? Because you've been talking about your brush and stuff.
As much as I try and get away from it, the Winsor & Newton Series 7 seems to do the trick every time, or at least so far. I keep jumping back and forth between Scharf and some other Kolinsky-type stuff, but all that seems to work out well, and FW inks and Sumi inks, Sumi A inks, and sticks and fan brushes and kind of anything that's at hand that'll get the job done. I think it probably goes to the illustration stuff, where, you know, it doesn't matter what you're doing, you have to find a way to solve the problem and tell the story. So especially in terms of supplies or materials to use, you know, whatever's at hand and whatever I can afford, and you know, whatever I can turn to make the texture, you know, put the mark down, that'll kind of apply to whatever theme or mode or style or presentation that needs to be done to solve the problem is usually what I grab to get it done. And all the brush stuff and the ink, I'd always been a fan of printmaking, and this UK OA show came through called Beauty and Violence. And it was this collected book of Yoshitoshi's woodblock prints. And I was totally blown away, because in illustration at that time, it was the old boys club and traditional illustration, and contemporary illustration back then was Society of Illustrators. And there's nothing wrong with that. I really like some of those illustrators, but I never really felt a connection mm-hmm. to much of that, or felt it would be a way to work. And so I kind of floundered for a long time, and my portfolio was all over the place. And this show came through, and it just about knocked me over. I think I skipped a good couple of days of school just to be in there and stare at those prints all day. And you know, I bought the book and started doing research and getting more into woodblock prints, and you know, they use brushes and you know, the ink and making the ink blocks and the wood cutting, and it all that spoke to me, especially with all the printmaking background. So I did everything I could to try and make a brush mark without actually using a brush for some stupid reason. And then about 5 years later, I just gave up and got a hold of a brush and started tackling it. Yeah. But that one show and Yoshitoshi stuff and seeing Hokusai stuff in Italy and some other random originals here and there really got me going on using the brush, because I thought I always wanted to paint everything, but then, you know, traditional stuff and none of those techniques really seemed to fit, because all I wanted to do was just draw, and the brush seemed like a suitable medium between the two. So I've been trying to develop that ever since.
What kind of print did you do for the Beast Print Show?
I did. Ended up doing a silkscreen with a local printer here at Valhalla Studios.
Valhalla.
In Kansas City, and wanted to try and mess it up as good as possible, and get as old and retro as I can in the printing, and the four color separation with the dot screen that he ended up using did an amazing job. I mean, it looks like an old 70s print. So for the B show, that's what we ended up doing.
I love the fact that for the Beast show that Jacob wanted to make sure that everything was actual prints and not giclée prints.
Yeah, I thought that was really, really awesome.
Yeah, because I get very bored of going to a show and, oh, look, someone printed that off of their computer.
Yeah, it's getting harder. I mean, traditional printing is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, digital prints are great, too. I'm not going to knock them, but as a printer, I'd rather...
It's that aesthetic.
What's that?
It's the aesthetic. The something was involved in making that.
Yeah. And the presses and the machines and, you know, hand-pulling this and mixing ink for that. It's just, I mean, you know you're a printer when you get addicted to the smell of ink. you have to have it every day. And, you know, I mean, you can stick your nose up to any of those prints and you can smell it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I probably should have huffed more glue in high school or something. I don't know.
No, that would probably have been even worse. No, that's interesting, though. Like, I really, and especially for you, I guess, because you love the mechanics of things and taking it apart and just seeing how it's working. So printmaking must be fascinating just for seeing the different types of printmaking and how that goes into making that process.
Yeah, most definitely. And hopefully soon, you know, I'll be able to do some letterpress. I've never been able to do that. Learn how to run a letterpress. That's like the only thing left I really want to know how to learn. So hopefully there's more prints coming.
Nice. Well, I'm more than happy to see some handiwork. 3D. You love 3D. Why 3D? The 3D glasses and...
Yeah, I'd always liked it as a kid, but it just seemed kind of hokey.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started making my own art. And I really want to sculpt, but the casting's really expensive. And in grad school, we all had a thesis, and I had these plasticine pin-up figures that I had cooking with some big asses and some attitude, and was having a lot of fun. But then, as slow and silly as I am, I did not research the size of casting and the cost of casting at which I was sculpting. I kept searching for a way to do it, and I couldn't find anything. And so somehow, I don't know how it happened, but 3D popped in my head or was offered up as an idea by somebody. I'm not sure which. And it fit. I mean, I could draw, and then I could separate it by hand and move everything around and you know, be able to sculpt space. Play around with depth of field and volume on a 2D surface, and it was much more affordable. So that's kind of how it started, was, you know, needing a way to solve a problem, to get some sculptural spatial issues dealt with, and it ended up doing the cake, and that led to a 10 by 15 foot 3D painting that I ended up doing for my thesis, and larger 3D stuff that I should never have done by hand, and thank God I had assistance. But I just kind of got addicted to it, and those 3D Scully train prints were hopefully the first of 32 Spectres, and were done in the Oban woodblock format, and so just kind of connecting everything together and just trying to see how far I can push.
Mm-hmm.
You know, printing and drawing and sculpture, you know, on a page. When I draw, I usually draw sculpturally. There's always form and mass to just about everything I'm trying to put down. And that whole idea that a blank page is not a blank page, it seems like a naked volume of 3D space to me. So it felt really good to finally get some spatial depth that could, you know, almost anybody could see, you know, with the glasses.
Well, it's fun to see people playing with images and seeing what you can do with it. So
yeah, it's really cool. And those 3D decks really I think those are the things that got me really addicted to it. That's fun.
I'm at the end of my allotted time. Given there's people staring at me through the window, needing the studio, so I have to bring this to a close. Thank you so much for taking the time and chatting with me today.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
And please send me, I think, 3 or 4 song requests that
sure.
I can mix in to for the play.
It's by all means.
Radio, it's music, you know. It all goes hand in hand. So.
Sounds good.
Thank you so much, Nathan.
My pleasure.
Folks, check out foxnathan.com and for more info.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, talk to you there.
Cheers.
Bye. That was Nathan Fox. Like I said, check out foxnathan.com. Great stuff. Pigeons from Hell, as well as Fluorescent Black from Heavy Metal Comic. In Heavy Metal, Pigeons from Hell is published by Dark Horse. The book is out, the collection. Check it out. Great stuff. I love the hyperviolence for kids.
Peoria Jazz! Go Dudlow Joe! I can break out of any old chair you know. The bars are iron, the walls are stone. Need me is a whole fishbone. Some fish in the jailhouse tonight. Some fish in the jailhouse tonight. Some fish in the jailhouse tonight. All right, oh yeah. There's some fish in the jailhouse tonight. In the jailhouse, fish in the jailhouse tonight. Gonna be an open line, hammerhead shark, steelhead salmon, or a mudbank carp. I said one side door, I went to the other side shark. Saturday night, I be in Central Park. In the jailhouse tonight. All right. Look at here, that's some fish in the jailhouse tonight. All right. There's some fish in the jailhouse tonight. Oh boy. That's some fish in the jailhouse. Fish in the jailhouse tonight. Ask little son Jackson or the 44 kid. Rolling Fork, Natchez to Kenosha, Newtown to New York. Some fish in the jailhouse tonight. All right. Look at here, fish in the jailhouse tonight. In the jailhouse tonight. With some bitch in the jailhouse tonight. With some fish in the jailhouse. Fish in the jailhouse tonight. Another seat. I'm gonna fashion me a fishbone skeleton key. Tell Scullion Child. in the jailhouse tonight. Serving fish in the jailhouse. Fish in the jailhouse tonight. Serving fish in the jailhouse tonight. Serving fish in the jailhouse tonight. All right.
Looking to fulfill your passion for justice? Join us. Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter is looking for women volunteers to help us run our 24-hour rape crisis line and transition house for battered women and their children. Training is 6 weeks long and free. Training starts now. Please call to book a training interview. Phone us at 604-872-8212.
We'll be right back. been roaming around, always looking down at all I see. Painted faces fill the places I can't reach. You know that I could use somebody. You know that I could use somebody. Someone like you and all you know and how you speak. Countless lovers undercover of the street. You know that I could use somebody. We'll be right back.
not for a dance. You know I'm a dancing machine, with the fire in my bones and the sweet taste of kerosene. I get lost in the light so high, I don't wanna come down. The faith, the loss of the good thing that I found.
Aussi. Au quatre.
In the dark of the night, I can hear you calling my name. With the hardest of hearts, I still feel full of pain. So I drink and I smoke and I ask you if you're ever around. Even though drove us right in the ground. See, the time we shared, it was precious to me. All the while I was dreaming of reverie. Gonna run, baby, run like a stream down a mountainside.
Avec Marie-Ève Dumoulin pour tout savoir sur les activités culturelles francophones de Vancouver et ses environs. Plus de la musique 100% francophone du Québec et d'ailleurs.